The day I realized I was a part of the sandwich generation was when I was sitting at my computer paying my mortgage, paying a school fee for my son, and taking on my dad's first bill.
When I had a preschooler and a toddler, I got a call from my previously very independent mom that she was in the hospital.
My mom was diagnosed with ALS officially, and it made the most sense to move them in next door.
So we're expecting our first baby boy in end of August. And when I think about what that is gonna feel like to take care of my wife and my new son and my mom, it's a bit overwhelming.
So I have the guilt of not spending time with my mom when I'm with my son, but then when I'm with my sons, I feel like my time with my mom is limited.
I also had to take over guardianship for my adult brother with Down syndrome, so it was actually more like a sandwich with a side of fries.
I have kind of prided myself on being self-sufficient, and in this season of life, that's almost been laughable.
This is Health Cue from Nashville Public Radio and KFF Health News.
Health Cue, like IQ, but for health. We're hoping to be your approachable guide to an unapproachable health system. And today we're bringing you some healthcare know-how from those of us wedged in the sandwich generation.
Yeah, and that includes both of us. I'm Blake Farmer with Nashville Public Radio, here with Kara Anthony from KFF Health News. We're both healthcare reporters and also sandwich generation folks. This Health Cue special really hits close to home for both of us and, you know, you, Kara, especially.
Oh, yes. I'm right in the thick of it. I have a 9-year-old daughter, plus my parents are close by and they need more and more from me every day.
So when did you realize that you really were in the thick of it, this sandwich generation?
Look, I was in denial about this for a very long time, but a recent experience was a real wake-up call for me. My dad was sick and he needed to go to the ER. And meanwhile, my mom and my daughter are at home, hungry, without food. The clock is ticking. My dad's still on an ER stretcher. I finally get home and Lily is still up. And at this point, it's like close to midnight.
Oh my gosh, you know that you're going to pay for that in the morning. I know the feeling. Well, I could see why that would be a wake-up call. You know, we've heard stories like this from all over the country. You know, if you're taking care of a child and you have a parent who is retirement age, like 65 and up, there's a lot of us who are right there with you. A quarter of American adults fall into that category, and that's according to Pew Research. And the reason more of us are squeezed here, it's kind of simple. A lot of us waited a little longer to have kids, and our parents are living longer. But that does mean that you've got this time where you've got kids who might need your care and parents who start really leaning on you. Now, if you choose to accept being a caregiver, also here, you've got your own health that's starting to fail a little bit or needs more attention around this time.
Whew, okay. The big takeaway, being in the sandwich generation can be very intense. And it's even more intense if you're taking care of your aging parents. Being a caregiver is like taking on a whole new identity.
I'm calling it our caring era. It's not really catching on yet, but we'll see. To be honest, though, I've never really thought of myself as a caregiver. I mean, even with kids. I mean, it's, you don't really have a choice. Changed a lot of diapers, but I had a parent who died from ALS and my mother needed tons of care. I certainly was involved, you know, but it was mostly my dad who was caregiving for my mom. Now, I'm obviously still involved with the kids, and I will be with my father at some point, but I don't know. I'm just not really a caregiver.
Okay. I have a lot of thoughts about this.
I know.
As you know, we talked about this before. So let's cue our first game. It's called Make Me Care. Let me see if I can make you care about why it matters, why you should really think of yourself as a caregiver.
All right, if we're going to play a game, we need some music. Cue the music.
Blake, look, I was in denial for years about being a caregiver.
Okay, denial. Why?
Well, first of all, it's a lot of work. It's like I have to do a job that I didn't apply for, and I keep getting promoted without pay. Every year, I'm taking on new assignments and more responsibility, taking my parents to the ER as needed, driving my mom around when my dad can't, light cleaning, meals, the list goes on and on and on.
I don't care how many promotions I'm going to get. I don't want this job either.
Yes, it's a lot. But even though I resist the identity of a caregiver sometimes, and really it happens a lot, I wish I had owned this earlier. I recently spoke to Denise Brown. She is a caregiving coach who lives in Illinois. And back in the 90s, she created this framework for caregiving. She has six stages, but let's talk about the first three. Denise says the first stage is being the expectant caregiver. Then you have the freshman caregiver and the entrenched caregiver. But the first stage actually happens when you start to worry about someone in your life, when you start to worry about a loved one that might need a little bit more help.
And I think what often starts a caregiving experience for individuals is worry. You're starting to worry about someone in the family. And it's not necessarily around defining caregiving by tasks and chores, but about that emotional impact of caregiving.
Yeah, I started worrying about my parents' health years ago, really when my mom started having some trouble walking. Back then, she didn't need a walker, but I really could have started calling myself a caregiver the moment I noticed that things were changing.
But to be honest, I'm not sure I understand why it matters to call yourself a caregiver, even when you're not, what seems to me to be actively caregiving.
Naming it changes the way you prepare for the future. Let's turn back the hands of time. Remember when you were expecting your first child? You didn't wait until that baby was born to get ready.
Well, yeah. I mean, if I recall, there were a bunch of baby showers. We got gifts. We also got some wisdom imparted on us.
Yes, it's the same thing with caregiving. Calling yourself a caregiver and really owning it, when you do that, you're able to tell your friends, your family, and even your boss that you might need a little bit more help and patience. And research also shows that people who call themselves caregivers are more likely to reach out for help. And in several states, they even have some kind of caregiver tax credit.
Wait, listen, if there is a financial benefit, this is something I can get on board with. All right.
Yeah, but the biggest thing when you are kind of embracing your role as a caregiver, it allows you to have better conversations with the people that you're caring for. I recently just had a conversation with my own mom, and this is probably the first time we ever sat down to talk about this. And I was just really happy and kind of surprised that she understood how stressful all of this can be for me.
You don't want to put us on the back burner, but yet you have a job that you're working. You don't want to put your daughter on the back burner, but you have your parents that you're taking care of. So that's my concern. I'm concerned about your health as well.
I felt so seen after that conversation with her. So if you don't mind, I'd like to reintroduce myself to you right now. Hi, Blake. My name is Kara, and I am a caregiver to my amazing parents.
Wow. Well, it's nice to meet you, Kara, the caregiver. I might not be right there with you just yet, but it sounds like I am at least an expectant caregiver. This is Blake Farmer and Kara Anthony from HealthQ, from Nashville Public Radio and KFF Health News. We are talking about how to approach being in this sandwich generation. So we've embraced the value of identifying as a caregiver. And you mentioned, Kara, that Denise had come up with this whole list of stages of caregiving, six different stages. What stage are you in?
Oh, I'm in deep. I'm stage three. Yeah. I'm an entrenched caregiver. Groceries, all the things, pharmacy runs, you name it, I'm there as needed.
Well, I haven't spent a lot of time with you now. I do know there are siblings. You have siblings. Are they allowed to embrace the title of caregiver as well, even though they are not physically present? They don't live in the same city with you guys near St. Louis?
Yes, this is so important. Caregivers show up in all sorts of ways. Denise and I talked a lot about this. You can be an emotional caregiver. My sister and my brother, they both listen to my mom and dad when they're going through things and helping them work through things just on the phone. That's super helpful. They also are financial caregivers. They send us stuff, DoorDashes, whatever they need. You know, I'm on the ground as a physical caregiver and really making things happen, you know, in the physical sense, but it's really important to know that caregiving shows up in all different forms, shapes, and sizes.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing a great job. Boots on the ground.
Yeah. So let's talk about your caregiving situation, because you said before that you really didn't identify as one.
Well, yeah, and it's probably because I lean too heavily on my wife. Shout out Mariah. You know, we kind of have an agreement. If push came to shove, I would do more, certainly if she needed me to give care to her. But it sounds kind of old-fashioned, but I think of myself a little more as like, all right, I'm going to focus on being the provider, you know, job, income, insurance for everybody. And you know, she's okay with that.
Yeah, I know you've talked to Mariah a lot about this, and we wanted to hear from her, too. So our producer, Catherine, called her up. Here's what she had to say about being the family caregiver.
I like being the caregiver. I like being the one that people need. I just like that people can rely on me. I feel like that is just a great quality to have, being reliable. And I like that I can be that for people. But I think some gratitude is what goes a long way. Just saying thank you for being the flexible person. Thank you for altering your schedule when needed to take care of the people who need help. And honestly, I think that's probably all I really need.
Sounds like I've got some thank yous to dish out. And listen, I when push comes to shove, I will be there when I'm needed. But I'm going to also give a little more thank yous. Let me turn it around to you, because you've made me uncomfortable here. You take on so much for your family. So let me ask the uncomfortable question. What would it look like if you took on less?
It's really hard for me to imagine taking on less, because I really feel like this is my responsibility. I worry so deeply about what their lives would look like if someone else was doing their caregiving. But also, I just want to take a moment to say here that I think mom and dad would really figure this out if I wasn't around. Maybe they would get their drugs delivered, their pharmaceutical drugs delivered, and you know, things like that would be put into place. But also, it's not all bad. Like, our caregiving situation, while I am exhausted, there's a lot of beauty in this too. You know, I often get to see my parents interact with Lily, and they just so enjoy spending time together. My mom is the one who helps Lily with her homework every day. And so I just want to say that this can also be a very beautiful experience.
Well, you know, earlier we heard many voices from around the country, folks in this sandwich generation, and there was a lot of stress and exhaustion, just like from you. But many of those same folks told us there was this joy and gratitude layered into the sandwich. One of them was Jason McAnally from Nashville. Two kids, ages 11 and 1.5, and he helps with care for his dad.
My dad is someone who is a very giving person, and that's looked like helping, like coming over and mowing my lawn and things like that. And right now he's at a place where he has less physically to offer. And even though he can't take care of my kids by himself, they absolutely love him. And so him just being around them without having to offer them anything other than his attention has been a really dutiful thing. I mean, I have a lot to be thankful for.
Yeah, Jason, I feel you, and so many of us can relate.
All right, coming up, we want to make being part of the sandwich generation a little easier by boosting your health cue about this stage of life. We're going to start by talking about an option to take time off of work when caregiving that a lot of people do not fully understand.
And we're going to talk about our kids, an important part of the sandwich, and how their mental health is one of the biggest challenges that arises in parenting.
Plus, we didn't leave ourselves out. We're going to talk about our own health and what to know about screening for early onset cancers, especially if you're in that core sandwich generation age range.
More Health Cue on the way. Welcome back to Health Cue, a special from KFF Health News and Nashville Public Radio. I'm Kara Anthony, here with Blake Farmer.
I'm right here.
Today, we're talking about the sandwich generation. And for many of us in this stage of life, that means we're balancing our jobs and caregiving for both our kids and parents.
Yes, although, as we've heard, some of us are doing a lot more balancing than others, Kara. But yes, we're in this generation together.
Well, sometimes it's just too much. Jill Woodrow, who lives in Rahway, New Jersey, faced the situation a few years ago. Her mom was a cancer survivor, and she had several new symptoms that were concerning. She was also starting to have a hard time driving, and she couldn't remember what her doctors were saying at the appointments. So Jill decided to step in and take her mom to the doctor.
Was working full time. I have three children, you know, and then also taking care of my mom. And, you know, I was having to leave work earlier, take sick time, personal time. And all of a sudden, my best friend said to me, Jill, have you ever thought about taking FMLA? And honestly, I never did.
FMLA is the Family and Medical Leave Act. This is the federal law that provides 12 weeks of unpaid leave for medical issues, parental leave, or for caregiving for a close family member who's in a serious health condition.
Jill decided to take FMLA to help with her mom's care. She said the hardest part was dealing with her own feelings about taking time off.
I did feel very guilty. You know, I'm a school social worker. I have a lot of students on my caseload, and I felt so guilty about leaving them.
But she worked with her employer to plan and train a temp worker to take over for her. She took 8 weeks to take care of her mom. On the other side, no regrets.
It really just opened up my days where I didn't have to worry about, like, asking my boss, can I leave early? And it was nice, too, because then my mom was able to come to our house. I was able to cook for her, help her out with food shopping. It wasn't just doctor appointments. It was doing household things as well.
So joining us now to talk more about FMLA and how to navigate this decision is Jocelyn Fry, president of the National Partnership for Women and Families, the organization which helped get the original FMLA legislation passed in 1993. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, Jocelyn, I kind of want to start with a spicy question. FMLA provides up to 12 weeks a year of unpaid leave for caregiving, unpaid. Taking time off without pay doesn't sound that great. I mean, should we really be calling this a benefit?
You know, it's a great question, Blake. You know, I think it is a benefit, but it has its limitations. And one of them is that it's unpaid leave. When the FMLA was passed in 1993, it was groundbreaking. It had never been done before, and it was a shift for folks to think about accommodating work-family needs as a workplace policy. So it was a groundbreaking shift, but a lot of folks can't take unpaid leave. If you look at the data, I think just under half of people say they don't take paid leave because they can't afford to be out of work.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I could be out of work for 12 weeks and it'd be a real challenge.
Yeah, it is. It is true.
Dustin, let's very quickly break down some of the logistics of FMLA. Are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Absolutely.
All right. Who is eligible to take FMLA?
Well, you have to be a worker with an employer that has 50 or more employees, and that worker has to work at least 1,250 hours a year for at least 12 months prior to taking the leave, and you have to have worked for the employer for 12 months. So about 45% of workers are not eligible for FMLA because they don't meet one of those requirements.
Okay, this is good to know. Let's jump right into the next one. When can you take FMLA for caregiving as opposed to just taking sick time?
The definition is basically, and Blake said it at the beginning, it's a serious health condition. So serious is open to interpretation. It tends to be a condition that will require an overnight stay in the hospital. It's something that is either a chronic condition that's going to be occurring for a long time or a condition that's going to keep you out of work for, you know, three or more days. Paid sick days tend to be for illnesses that are much shorter duration.
It still seems like it would be a challenge to determine what qualifies for FMLA, but
I mean, sometimes you can have a doctor's note that can also confirm this is a, you know, a serious condition that is going to require, you know, 2 weeks of recuperation, that type of thing.
This is great information. And last rapid fire question here. Is it possible to get paid for FMLA?
Yes, although the FMLA doesn't require it. There's sort of two ways that people tend to get paid while taking paid family and medical leave under the FMLA. One is that they're in one of the 15 states now, including DC, that has paid family and medical leave as a requirement across the state. In those states, employers are required to provide paid leave. Obviously, if you haven't hit the lottery and you're not in that state. The other way that you can typically do it is if you have paid vacation or other forms of paid leave, you can tell your employer, well, I want to use my week of vacation or 2 weeks of vacation as part of my FMLA leave. So it will run concurrently, but that way you're getting paid for a portion of it. That tends to be the way that people do it.
Sounds like one way or the other, you're having a long conversation with human resources about this before you take FMLA. If you're just joining us, you're listening to HealthQ from Nashville Public Radio and KFF Health News. We're talking to Jocelyn Fry from the National Partnership for Women and Families.
Jocelyn, some people are all in for taking extended time off. But for some of us, we might avoid taking leave because we have all sorts of anxieties. We're talking about navigating office politics, wanting to be seen as a team player, not wanting to put too much extra work on our coworkers.
Yeah, and even though it's protected, I think some of us are thinking about the long term, like, would this put our job at risk down the road when we get back?
Yes, personally, I've thought about this a lot, and I know I might face this decision down the road. So help us. If I'm feeling unsure, if we're feeling unsure about FMLA, whether to take it or not, you know, how do we decide?
The way I would start is, first and foremost, just thinking about what your need is. If you're, you know, if your mom is sick or your dad is sick or your spouse, then they have to be your priority. And I would always encourage people just to first start with what is it that you need and think it through and have a plan. The second thing I would say is that with your employer, even if you're not planning to take leave now, but you're sort of planning for the future, to really talk to them about how do you actually do education across the organization. This is a benefit. It's available to all. And you have to create a culture in the organization that allows people to take it. And if people think that they're going to lose a promotion or something like that, that's A, it's not supposed to happen. It's prohibited by, you know, law. You're not supposed to be penalized for it. And you have to create a culture that says everybody is welcome to take leave. What we know from the data, I will say, is that there are lots of people who express the very concerns you raise. I think it's a little over 40% of workers say they don't take it because they're worried that it will affect their job in some way. We know men often don't take it because they think men aren't supposed to take leave. It's really supposed to be women. So we try to encourage people to defy those stereotypes. And that's important for workers themselves, but it's also important for employers to create an environment where people do actually feel like they can take leave that they're entitled to take.
Well, Jocelyn, it's almost like you're reading my mind here about men. I'll just fess up. I mean, I think I would be hesitant to consider taking time away when it comes to FMLA. What would you say to men beyond, you know, just defying the stereotypes?
You know, what I'd say is that increasingly, if you look at the research, more and more men say, I want to be involved in my family. I want to support, you know, my mom or my parent when they're sick. And I want to be something different than maybe what the stereotypes dictated men to be, you know, decades ago. And I would say to any man, you know, you are entitled to support and be involved in your family. The other thing I would say is that what we know from the research, again, in states that have paid leave, is that men are more likely to take it when you have a sort of a gender neutral benefit. That's one of the reasons that the FMLA was passed in the first place, is that without it, women were always the ones who were doing the caregiving, and they were more likely to be targeted in a negative way. When you have a benefit like the FMLA that is gender neutral, it's available to everybody, it helps to create the expectation that this is not about men versus women. This is about whoever needs to provide care and supporting them in that time of need.
By gender neutral, are you saying that this isn't just maternity leave or something?
That's exactly right. It's paid family and medical leave. It's for a serious health condition, for your own health condition, or for that of a family member. So it gets us out of the box of only being for maternity or paternity purposes and understands that, you know, family caregiving is also important.
Okay, all of this is really helpful. I'm starting to feel smarter already. But really hold Blake's hand here. How do we start to have this conversation with our managers? Like, literally, Jocelyn, give us a script. If someone is making this decision, what do we say?
Well, I would start with saying everybody has a care need. You know, caregiving is, you know, part of the lifeblood not only of our communities and our families, also our workplaces. And so I'd say to any manager, let's start with a realistic expectation of the different things that are likely to affect workers in this workplace, and to make sure that we're creating a space so that they can be successful. We know from data that when people are able to take leave and manage their work-family responsibilities, they tend to be more productive. There's better morale, and you can plan for absences. So I think it's a good strategy for actually making the workplace more productive and more efficient, and actually trying to bring issues that are, you know, sometimes hidden from view, people don't want to talk to create sort of more transparency around how do we make sure that we're accommodating these needs in a way that actually works for our workplaces. And let's talk through how we can do that. The last thing I'd say is that to any manager, I'd say, I want to work with you to make this work for everybody, just as I would want to support you when you have a care need, because chances are that manager is going to have one in their lifetime.
Well, I understand that you kind of went through this a bit when you were working in the White House. I think your mom was very ill. How'd you navigate that?
I did a little bit of what I just said. You know, I was fortunate that I worked with people who I knew, as a practical matter, supported these types of policies. And I talked to my mom a lot about what she needed. My mom had cancer a few years after my dad had lost his life to cancer. And I needed to be there for her when she needed me. She wanted to be somewhat independent, but she wanted to stay at home. We had somebody as a caregiver during the day, and then I would come in the evening. And that's the way I knew she wanted to live her life and end her life. And that was my first priority. And, you know, I think that the thing I would say about FMLA, not everybody has to, I didn't take FMLA. But I had sufficient flexibility that if I needed to leave early to take my mom somewhere, or if I needed in, you know, the last couple of weeks of her life when I needed more extended time just to be there with her, I could do that. And I think that's the type of flexibility that people are often looking for. When my dad needed me to drive him to chemo, I just, you know, needed to be able to come in a little bit later so I could take him in the morning, and then I would stay later at work. In many ways, this is about what are the reasonable types of arrangements that we can make with our employers to accommodate needs that many of us are going to have in our lifetimes, without sort of impeding our work in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I could imagine that, gosh, if your mom and dad could see you now, they would be so proud. And you've been on the ground floor of this topic for a long time. And let's just acknowledge that there haven't been any major changes to FMLA legislation since it passed in 1993. So, Jocelyn, if you could wave a magic wand and change it, what would you like to see?
I would do a couple of things. One is, you know, I mentioned the fact that The employers who are covered have 50 or more employees. So there are lots of small employers who are not covered by the FMLA. That leaves out a good percentage of workers. So I'd probably reduce the employer-employee sort of threshold. I'd make it paid. You know, I'd figure out a way to get pay through the FMLA. If not, I certainly would make clear that there was a fairly narrow family definition, and what you see in many of the paid leave laws in states is that they broaden that to cover, you know, more than your parents and your spouse and your kids. The last thing is, you know, we're fighting for paid family and medical leave at the national level. Our view is that every worker should have access to leave, and they should not fear losing their job and their livelihood when they need care or their family needs care.
So we're wrapping up here. If you could have our listeners remember just one thing when they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to take FMLA or not, what would you hope that people would keep in mind?
You know, caregiving is a part of life. So they should never feel guilty about the fact that they may need to take time out of the workforce to provide care for a loved one or take care of their own health need. We are in a society that often pushes people to work 24/7. And I certainly understand that's critical and important, you know, for people's economic stability. And I wouldn't take people away from that. But caregiving is essential to how our country functions, our economy functions. When people need to provide care, they need to be able to do so without sort of being on the defensive 24/7. And I'd say to people, you know, be thoughtful about the choices, speak with your family member, see what they need and try to be responsive to them. And then be unafraid to say to people, this is what I need to be productive at work and also responsible to my family and to know their rights. And hopefully that conversation can be a positive one.
Jocelyn Fry, thank you so much for being here. Jocelyn is president of the National Partnership for Women and Families.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
When we come back, we're jumping into the other side of the sandwich when kids need a little more help than we can give them. We'll be right back with more Health Q. Health Q is back. I'm Blake Farmer with Kara Anthony. We're healthcare reporters with Nashville Public Radio and KFF Health News. And we're now joined by Dr. Paris Goodyear Brown, founder of Nurture House and a mom of three kids. She works with children and teens with anxiety and depression in Franklin, Tennessee. Welcome to HealthQ, Paris.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, you know, I haven't even told you why you're here. No, you know, but I'll tell the audience. We're talking about the sandwich generation today, caring for parents and kids. And, Kara, I want to talk about kids because I wonder, have you ever worried about the mental health of your little Lily? And if so, considered counseling?
Yes, just last week, Lily and I, we went to the park. We were flying kites. Now, it was time to drive over to the playground section of the park. We get in the car, and Lily sees other kids on the playground, and she refused to get out of the car. She was so anxious, I think, about playing with other kids, and I thought, ooh, we need to start thinking about therapy.
Well, Dr. Goodyear Brown, I mean, we know that therapy can be so helpful for anxious kids, but it's also hard to just want to try out. You've got to find a therapist like yourself. Many of them don't take insurance. Average cash pay a couple years ago was $150 an hour. So the question we're trying to answer here is, how can we feel more confident just as a parent starting out on this journey?
Yeah, let's jump right into this. So how would you rate the health cue of most parents when it comes to counseling?
Well, I would say that this generation of parents is more educated and more open to therapy altogether for themselves and their kids than the previous generation. I'm often sitting with parents and asking about their parents' history and any family psychiatric history and so forth. And they often say, I don't know, that wasn't a thing that we ever talked about back then. And, it just was hush hush. And so I think in the sense of being open to trying to get help, this generation is more open. There is, though, still some stigma around therapy? And if I send my child to therapy, will they feel broken or bad? Or does it mean I'm a bad parent? You know, those are the kinds of vulnerabilities in us as the grownups that come up.
Oh, well, yeah.
Is there a way you might advise parents when they're thinking about behavior of a child and trying to figure, does this rise to the level? Is therapy something I need right now?
I think the fact that the question is being asked is important. If a parent has gotten to the point where they're saying, like, do I need therapy? Does my child need therapy? It's already become important. But then you'd want to think about things like, how long has this been going on? How intense is the behavior? Does it impede the child's social functioning or any other area of development for them? So if this, for example, with Lily is a one-off, she had a hard day and wasn't quite ready to be with other kids, that's a whole different scenario than refusing to go into her preschool classroom day after day after day. Parents are often calling about things like separation anxiety when their kids first hit the preschool years and they're having their first moments of, you know, they've had their safe boss, nurturer, storykeeper parents around the whole time. And now it's normal for a child to have some anxiety about separating from them. But then the question is, if it does the child quickly turn back around? Maybe they're crying, mommy, don't leave me. But then as soon as the parent has departed, they enjoy the day and they're engaged with their teachers. That's a really different presentation than the child who cries for 3 hours at school, is inconsolable, and isn't able to learn.
So that's like frequency is kind of like, is this just a one-off thing? Duration, is that lasting most of the day? If
yes.
It's like a separation thing. What about intensity? What are measures of intensity with behaviors in kids?
Well, it depends on which category you're talking about, but I would say things like some anxiety around going to sleep. You know, if the child gets out of the bed 2 or 3 times a night and they're still trying to figure out, do you mean it, and they need to stay in their bed, or are they unable to get to sleep at all because, or are they having nightmares that they're waking up from multiple times in the night? Are they not getting full REM sleep? Those kinds of things would be more about intensity. It would be the same with when anxiety reaches the level of obsessive compulsive kinds of behaviors. Even that's on a gradation. But if you have a child who won't leave the house without making sure all their toys are lined up just right, or they have to check whether the doors are locked over and over again 10 times a night before they can go to bed, that's a much higher intensity of disruption. Then
we're looking at each other over here. They go, oh, there's some behaviors we need to check out.
You are reading my mail.
Well,
let's move on to another family to talk about. But we talked to Marcella Cabe. She lives in the area outside Austin, Texas, and talked to us about her daughter who was really spiraling and anxious and kind of thinking about the worst case scenario at every turn.
I kind of kept thinking, right, like, oh, maybe it will pass. Maybe it was this vacation, or maybe it was this thing that she has coming up at school, but it wasn't, you know, those things would happen and it wasn't getting any better. It was actually getting worse. She would just really tense up, or anytime that I would be like, yeah, I'm going to the store, or, you know, any daily outing, just really stressed out about, like, is it gonna rain? Are we gonna be okay?
And so Marcella's daughter was about 7 years old at the time. And so if you would, help us walk through this frequency, intensity, duration test with that kind of behavior of anxiety, of worst-case scenarios.
Yeah, so the thing about anxiety is that it will take as much territory as we give it. And so it's especially important if a child is showing multiple anxiety symptoms for the parent to at least seek some consultation from a mental health professional about, am I helping or am I working to try to soothe, which all parents want to do with their kids. But some of the soothing strategies we might try with our kids can actually reinforce the anxiety. And sometimes you need a teammate, you need a supporter, a mental health person to say, it's okay for you to say, we're going to help together boss back the anxiety. We're not going to say yes to it over and over again.
What would be some ways that we would encourage anxiety and not mean to?
Well, I'm thinking about a six-year-old boy who had moved here from California, and the school schedule was a little bit different. He already had a genetic predisposition to anxiety and then had some things happen in his family that were a bit traumatic. And then his mother picked him up. She was an amazing mom who got in the line 20 minutes before school was out, but still didn't realize our school on a half day is less. It gets out 11:30. And so she was a few minutes late to pick up her son. which with most kids would not matter at all. They'd be happily playing more with their friends. But this child became incredibly anxious that he was going to be left and abandoned at school, and got in the car and asked her, "Mom, can you make sure that never happens again? I felt so embarrassed and, you know, left out there." And she, of course, feeling bad, said, "Honey, no, of course, yes, I'll make sure I'm on time. For I just didn't realize the half day was this timing." That night again, before bed, he asked again, "Are you sure you're going to be there on time tomorrow? Are you going to be there? Okay, well, what is the time, Mom? Do you know the time?" And she answered him, and then she answered him again. And by the time they came in for treatment, he was asking and needing the answer over and over again, probably 30 times between the end of one school day and the beginning of another. Mm. So that's an example of the anxiety growing in a way where a parent is trying to reassure, but we may actually be feeding the worry.
Mm. I want to move on from the intensity and frequency and duration to talk a little bit about maybe things that go on that it just makes sense to automatically go to therapy. For instance, Marcella talked about a few years before this behavior was showing up, mm-hmm. they'd been through a very rough divorce, had not done counseling therapy together. Are there big life events that you think just automatic?
Absolutely. I don't necessarily believe that every single life event that people might call traumatic will need intervention, but basically all of the categories of trauma that we would call the ACEs for short, but the adverse childhood experiences, all of those, and just to list a few of them, there's sexual abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, substance abuse of a parent, mental illness of a parent, incarceration of a parent. Like, these things seem to be much worse for our children than things like a discrete house fire or car accident or something. And that's because those pervasive attachment relationship wounds rob the child of the available caregiver, the serve and return back and forth need meeting stuff that kids need. So in those sorts of situations, I would always want the caregivers, which might end up being foster and adoptive parents at times, to be seeking at least some support around the story of what happened. Another time when I think it's important to seek out help is when something hard has happened and the parents are feeling like there's a vacuum of silence around it for the child, that they don't have the words to name suicide or sexual assault or whatever it is that needs to be cancer, whatever needs to be named. Often the parents themselves need support in crafting a coherent narrative.
Mm. It sounds like, the parent might need the counseling as much as the kid in those situations.
Yeah.
This is Carrie Anthony and Blake Farmer. You're listening to Health Q and counselor Dr. Paris on how to know when it's time for a kid to get professional help. Look, Dr. Paris, therapy is expensive. That might be the elephant in the room here. And I know it's not just a one-time thing. You're likely going to sign a child up for multiple sessions. So I'm just wondering if there's some middle ground. Like, is there another step you can take, like talking to a teacher or listening even to a parenting podcast? Mm-hmm. My daughter Lily likes to talk to my sister about her problems. Is that a good first step?
Yeah, I think having a team, you know, hopefully it takes a village, right? So if there are other safe boss adults who your child can go to, I would absolutely pull them in first. You know, kids are very protective of their parents' hearts and minds. And so sometimes they do need a safe other adult who they could talk to. I think also the school counseling resources are sometimes underused, and there are not necessarily in every school a licensed professional counselor, but there are trained individuals who work with social and emotional health and development. And there can even be some things like divorce care kinds of groups for kids in the schools, social and emotional learning groups for kids in the schools that wouldn't cost the parent anything. There's also all sorts of books and podcasts I think that can end up being harder rather than easier, though, for parents, because they might end up with 12 different parenting books on their night timetable, and they have read one chapter of each, and they all say conflicting things.
Yeah, just listen to this episode. It'll be enough.
But I'm guilty of that. I have a parenting book on the nightstand now. Dr. Paris, let's say we're ready to go ahead and sign our child up for therapy. there seems to be some conflict in that. And it's not easy because just the other day, my daughter, when I said, you know, Lily, I might take you to a therapist, she blurts out, there's nothing wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what to say to her in that moment. I tried to reassure her and let her know that lots of people go to therapy. But what should I have said? What can anyone say to a kid?
Well, I think starting out the way you did is just right. You know, we all have things that we struggle with, and they're special helpers for those moments when we're struggling. Some kids will know what is going on for themselves and ask and say, can I have a counselor? Other kids might be a little bit more hesitant, but if you can normalize this, we all have times where we could use some extra support. It tends to depathologize it for kids.
Mm. Dr. Paris Goodyear-Brown, thank you so much for joining us and helping us up our own health queue.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Dr. Paris is the clinical director, founder of Nurture House in Franklin, Tennessee.
Well, we've talked about the aging parents. We've talked about the growing kids. But there's one more part of the sandwich generation.
Are you talking about us? Like the filling?
Yes. Yes, the person sandwiched in between the generations.
Yeah, more than half of adults in their 40s are taking care of kids and have parents above retirement age. And if that's you, you might be too frazzled to keep a good eye on your health. But more than a dozen kinds of cancer are on the rise in adults under 50. So having a strong health cue about these is going to really help you catch cancers early when they're most treatable. So, Kara, welcome to the Health Cue Quiz. Early onset cancer edition. Can we smile about that? I don't know.
I don't know. I'm nervous, but here we go.
Okay.
Let's jump right in with question one. Which two of these cancers are on the rise the most in people under 50? Colorectal cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, or bone cancer?
I feel like I've heard colorectal's up. I'll go with also bone cancer.
Okay, one out of two isn't bad. Colorectal and breast cancers are increasing in people under 50 the most. Also, colorectal cancer is now the most deadly cancer for people in this age range.
Wow. All right, let's move to question two, which is related. What are the current recommended ages for a first mammogram, which scans for breast cancer, and a colonoscopy, which scans for colorectal cancer?
I'm going to go pretty young here and say 35 or 40.
Recommended age, 40 for a mammogram, 45 for a colonoscopy. However, your doctor might want you to get one of these scans much sooner, even in your 20s, depending on personal risk factors.
Okay, what are the personal risk factors?
Well, you know, one of the big ones is unusual symptoms that can be kind of scary, like blood in your stool, lump in the breast, ongoing fatigue, even unusual pain. Don't just wait for it to go away. Tell your doctor. Another very important risk factor is your family history. Bryce Ramsey was diagnosed with colorectal cancer at 33.
If I would have known that I had a significant family history, I would have been scoped a lot younger. After my diagnosis, I begged my dad and my aunt and my brother to all get screened, and it come back that all of them had colon cancer also.
Bryce's family members, they were all able to get treatment. They're doing well today. She said it can be uncomfortable to talk to older family members about their private health information, but, you know, maybe make a joke. Remind them it could save a life.
Wow. Okay, here we go. Last question. There are several at-home cancer screening kits. What should you do before taking one of these tests? And let's count down and say our answers together this time.
All right, so three,
two, one.
What? Talk to your doctor?
Oh, I said fast. Okay, you got it right. Talk to your doctor. That's good. Okay. We spoke to Dr. Vita Geary, director of the Early Onset Cancer Program at the Yale Cancer Center.
It's hard to know the accuracy of these tests, and some of these tests could lead to a false sense of either reassurance or false anxiety and alarm. So please talk to your doctor first before doing any at-home tests.
Positive or negative results, you're going to want to check in with your doctor about them. Your doctor is probably going to want to order their own screenings anyway, so save yourself some time and money by talking to your doctor about the best test for you first.
Well, it sounds like the most important thing any of us can do when it comes to our cancer risk is having a primary care doctor you trust.
Yes, but also let's be real, not everyone has a doctor. So at least get your screenings and get any unusual symptoms checked out sooner rather than later, just in case it is in fact cancer.
That's a wrap. HealthQ comes to you from Nashville Public Radio and KFF Health News.
Catherine Ruppelt is our senior producer and makes it all happen.
Emily Siner is our contributing editor.
Tanya English is our executive producer.
Can you help us boost our HealthQ? Share your tips with the group and make the healthcare system a little more approachable. Email us at info@betterhealthq.org. You can also find us on the socials. YouTube videos incoming. I'm Blake Farmer.
I'm Kara Anthony. See you next time.